Blog Talk Radio.
This is the UR Tennis Network. We are the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate tennis enthusiasts who promote our sport relentlessly. We strive continuously to bring news and information for players, parents, coaches, officials, businesses, and anyone else who loves tennis. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis may not be interested in them.
Are we on?
Yep, we're on. Let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamic Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the UR Tennis Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. Here we are today in Marietta, Georgia. I've got a great guest today. The number you'll be calling in on to talk to us on the show is 714-583-6053. You can call in at any time and ask our guest a question. We will be right back in just a few minutes. We're going to play our first commercial. When we come back, I'll tell you a little bit more about today's guest. You can pick up this broadcast on your iTunes podcast, or on your Blog Talk, or on my blog at CoachJPWeber.com. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with our guest for today's show.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunity. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to another edition of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show here on the UR Tennis Network. And we are here in the studio today with a very special guest, Coach Larry Graham. Today, we had all weekend, we've had, Tabani and I spent working, it's like it is with all these USTA tournaments. You're up early and, you know, out until late working on the tournaments, getting them ready for the kids and getting to go. We had a level 5 satellite tournament here. It's one of the more popular formats here in Georgia. And in fact, most of your tournaments here in Georgia are level 4, level 5 tournaments. And most of the kids that play tennis, that's the level of tournament they play. So we worked all weekend on that. Cold weather. But I love it. I love the cold weather. So we've got Coach Graham, a little bit more about Coach Graham here in a second. Let me get through some of the stuff we need to get through. If you want to call in today, you can call into the show at 714-583-6853. And you can also pick this show on the iTunes device. Okay, is that the way I'm supposed to say it? Yep. I'm still trying to get with this.
Anywhere you can get a podcast.
Anywhere you can get a podcast, okay. Or you can go to my blog at CoachJPWeber.com, and I'll make real easy links to it there. So you can pick it up there. And we went to our first commercial already, so let me get right to the guests we have today. Today I have Coach Larry Graham. Now, Coach Graham was here at the tournament, and I was so impressed with his kids. I was so impressed with him and his kids and watching what they were doing and how he was coaching them and took the time from the early morning, the start, until late here tonight when we got finished, that I just wanted to make a special effort to have him come on the show, and we're going to sit down and talk a little bit about tennis here. Remember, one of the reasons we started the We Coach Tennis site and the We Coach Tennis show was because we wanted to give a voice to who, you know, they may not be marquee names, coaches, it might not be marquee names, but they got marquee hearts and marquee minds, and they're the kinds of guys that I like to hang around and talk with. So we're just going to have a good conversation today, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing well, JP. I'm glad to be here with you.
Coach, you're from Mount Airy, North Carolina originally. You went to Davidson College on an academic scholarship.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I want people to understand is, Coach, you didn't pick up tennis until late. You picked it up late in the Air Force, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, I picked it up as a result of a challenge from some other athletes, and found out that the sport was not as easy or simple as it looked, and kind of became addicted to it.
Now, I mentioned, I want to make everybody, just so everybody knows, if you're not from this region, Davidson College is sort of what I call the Harvard of the South. So you went to school there at Davidson on an academic scholarship. So I've got to be very sharp today here in the room. I got to make sure I better not say any of my local stuff.
I just got to be sharper than they were in admitting me. So
you'll be fine. Coach, you spent a lot of time working in the Atlanta area. You spent a lot of time in the urban areas of Atlanta. You worked at Sugar Creek. You did Tennis Tech with the current coach at Clemson University, Chuck McEwen.
Yes.
And you're currently the director of tennis for Henry County.
Right.
For tennis in Henry County. And so I'm excited to have you on here. We got Tabani in the studio today as well. We ought to have a decent show here. Coach, one of the first things we usually do, we get right into our first segment, or the first segment that we have is the daily topic segments. And one of the segments that you're from down in Stockbridge.
Right.
And we've got a young girl who's one of the top players in the ITF, Taylor Townsend.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, it's not a daily topic in the sense that it hadn't happened today. Since I got you here, I'm going to put you on the spot. The USTA had her down there, I believe. Now, do you know a little bit of her history?
A little bit of it. Taylor was such a dynamic player that she was out of the region, you know, quite a bit. And I think what we're responding to here and what we're going to address is the situation that occurred with her at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, and that's part of the USGA team. And either she's supposed to be able to get in the U.S. Open or not, and they said, or she's supposed to be part of the team or not part of the team, and they said, well, you're not part of the team anymore because you need to work on your weight or something like that.
Well,
how did
I think,
it work?
What they did was, with the top juniors, they pay, they'll finance the trip to the U.S. Open, lodging, stuff of that nature for the players. And they decided they were not going to do it for Taylor because they felt that she was a little bit overweight, not in proper condition, which is kind of a tough thing to say when you're the top player in the world, girls junior tennis. You know, and the problem I have, I think it was addressed probably better by Serena Williams than anybody else, is that girls come in all sizes. And you can't afford to, at this stage of a young girl's development, you know, put her in a situation where she's concerned about looking like Maria Sharapova. She's not going to look like that. You know, she looks more like Vesely Maddox-Sands, who, you know, is a large girl and plays for the Fed Cup team. I think that if they're going to address that with anybody, address it with her. She's much older, much more mature, and probably able to handle it a little bit better than Taylor Townsend. They need to be more supportive of the family and of this junior player.
Do you have any relationship with the parents? Do you know them at all?
No, I don't. I do not.
Well, if I was the mom, I think I would be. I just can't imagine that. I mean, when it came across, I had to look at it two or three times, and I understand what they're meaning. As a coach, you and I understand
getting the athlete date, right?
Yeah, but see, that's not the USTA's responsibility. The USTA in this situation is supposed to be a support organization. You know, they're not the disciplinary organization for this kid because they're not their coach. They're not her coach.
They're not?
No. She has her own individual coach. She works under the auspices of the USTA, one with the junior program and the junior development program. But the USTA, like they do with pretty much every other situation, they get the top name players and they bring them in, and it's almost more promotion of the USTA than it is of the players. These players learn their games like most of the kids that you work with and the kids that are in the area with coaches that are not direct part of the USA Junior Development Program. Once they become known players, accomplished players, then they're brought into the system.
Coach, let me ask you a question. You got an opportunity in working here in the Atlanta area. There's some legendary, you know, I've seen some guys come through here, and you know, commonalities in maybe the way they are as people in the way that they act. There were several coaches in here. There's a guy named Ernie Peterson.
Yeah.
Did you ever just work with Ernie?
I worked with him, but I worked during the same time. You know, we had different groups of kids we worked with, but I did get to know Ernie too.
So you're coming into tennis late, and you're getting exposed to guys like Ernie Peterson. What was so great about a guy like Ernie Peterson?
Well, I think the thing that you look at with Ernie, and you'll find it with a lot of the coaches, is that they were loyal to their areas. You know. And he stayed in the College Park area working with those kids down there. And those were what you would call the early kids, and I hate to use the term disadvantaged because I think that's just something you apply to yourself. But, you know, he worked with those kids. And Ernie stayed there and worked with them.
Now, there was another coach that was, I guess, very instrumental in the black community in that area down there, Norm Wilkerson.
Yeah, Norm was the same way.
Did you get a chance to work with him around him as well?
Sure did. Norm talked with him, and in fact, I followed him at Sugar Creek as the director of tennis operations over there. And the other thing that you have to look at with these coaches is that when they were coming along, for whatever the reason, the opportunities that existed for them was limited to those areas. And you can say it's because, you know, maybe their associations, race, any number of things. But that was one of the limiting factors for those guys because you didn't see them as directors on the north side of Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
They were all on the south side.
And what was the strong point of, you know, the kids that they trained? What was it that came through that you saw that was what impressed you about these different guys?
Well, you know, really, when you look at it, there was no difference between them and a Jerry Baskin on the north side of Atlanta. It's just the race of the kids that they're working with, predominantly kids of it.
You said disadvantage is something you label yourself. In a sense.
Yeah.
But they kids that had this, that, or the other thing, and so I've had some struggles dealing with that here, but how were they able to come without money, without funding, and bring them on and be able to mentor them to a position where these kids could go any place? And, you know, what was it that they knew about working with this question coming through?
Well, I think, I'll try to be as clear in response to it as I can be. I think what they did is what most good coaches do. They put the kids first. You know, and if you put the kids first, you will reap the benefits on the backside. Unfortunately, in a lot of programs, it's money first, and then the kids come second. And that's why you have this assembly line mentality with these kids. These groups and run them through. And I think Ernie and I think Norm were the kids' development and the reflection it was going to have on the community.
So growing up in Mount Airy, mm-hmm. North Carolina, did you have a club that you were a member of or a country club or anything like that?
It was probably under the Farm Bureau because I grew up on a farm.
You grew up on a farm, so there wasn't any tennis.
No tennis.
So now you get in, apparently.
Yeah, and going back to Mount Airy, the time when I grew up in Mount Airy, and I'll, you know, go over this very briefly, tennis and golf were segregated sports at that time. So you were not allowed to be on a tennis court, a facility, or on a golf course unless you were a caddy. So there was no exposure to tennis when I was coming through as a young
How
person.
Long ago was that?
That
wasn't even that long ago. For me now, I mean, maybe for Tabani, You're 21, 20, 18, how old is he? Every week he gets younger, you know what I mean? Every week I get older, he gets younger. But for him, it was a long time ago. For me, when how long ago was that you were growing up? I mean, how old? You're 61, so,
yeah, 61, so I was,
what recollection of if you were a nine-year-old kid, that was what?
Oh, Lord. They integrated the schools in 1966. So
how
I
were you in 1966?
When I went to the schools, I was 18 and 70, so I guess that puts me at about 14.
So you're 14, 15, you can't go play tennis?
Well, up until like, 14 or 15, it was the same way with swimming. You couldn't go to the YMCA to learn to swim. And when they integrated the schools in the 60s, they did allow us to go to the YMCA and swim, but it was an odd day, even day thing.
And, you know, I mean, people can want to.
People come on Mondays, they change the water on Tuesdays.
No,
swim on Tuesday, change the water. The life game on Wednesday, we come on Thursday, they change the water on Thursday. That's the way it works, and I'm not kidding you. That is exactly the way it works.
Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah, I mean, you know.
So you didn't have to, so you pick it up at 25. Who's influencing you at 25? What brings you to the point that you start coaching tennis?
I got into coaching by accident because I was just totally enamored with the sport. It became addictive, and I wanted to be the very best that I could be.
What about this was addictive to you?
The challenge of trying to master this
was
sport.
Was it the little wooden racket back then, or was it, what was it? when you say the challenge, the physical challenge, or what was it, hitting that ball just right, or what?
Well, see, I've been in athletics all my life. I played football, basketball, baseball. They all came real easy to me. It seemed like it was just something that was natural. I picked up tennis, and all of a sudden I realized that I had no control of what I was doing. And that's what challenged me. That's the challenge. It was to the point where I could control the game in a controlled manner and fashion. And got into it. I became an obsessive type thing with me, and I became pretty bad at it. And
how good did you – you said you were ranked in Georgia?
I was one of the top 10 players in the state and top 20 in the South. And my determination was that I was going to play good enough to be competitive with the country club guys, the guys who had all the private lessons and all the formal education in tennis. I was determined that I was going to be that good. And that was my drive. That's always kind of driven me. And I had a parent walk up to him, asked me if I would work with his son. And my response was, you know, what do you mean work with him? He says, well, I want him to play like you. And that was my very first student. And he went on to play at UGA and became a very good player. He's now a lawyer in Atlanta. So that's how I got into it, and it's just kind of been by word of mouth since then, and it's been very productive for me.
Well, I saw you out here today. You have a pretty close relationship, not only with the kids, but the parents and everything. You seem to be a coach's coach or the coach's type of mentor guy. So you're huddling with the girls. What kinds of stuff were you talking about with the girls today? I'm curious what was going on out there on the court.
Well, I think one of the things that I try to emphasize with the girls. And it's probably something that becomes more of a factor with girls and boys, is to be an athlete. And what I mean by that is to accept the fact that there are going to be discomforts during the course of the match. There are going to be things that are going to be a distraction if you allow them to be, but to learn to overcome it. And it's something that we, as men and as boys, we come through in football, we learn to play with abrasions, we learn to play with contusions and even concussions to some degree, all kind of little, you know, minor irritants, what my coach would call. And girls, unfortunately, don't get a chance to come up through that. So they have to learn it in a different way. You know, they're not exposed to athletics like boys are for the most part.
Now, is that a little bit – is that not sexist? Cause,
not sexist.
I would imagine if Chrissy Everett or Martina Navratilova were here, they would say to you, now, look, I was number one for – 4 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
That's 12 months, and every month, you know, I got to deal with, you know, things that you don't even have a clue.
Yeah.
As I deal with. I mean, some of these women are tough. They might be tougher.
But they didn't start that way, and that's what I'm talking about with these kids. These are 10, 11-year-old girls, and so you're trying to get them to become athletes. And in some degree, boys are the same way. You know, when a kid first comes out there and puts that helmet on the first time he gets hit, the first thing he's going to do is he's going to feel pain and he's not going to want to go through it again. And it's a coach's job to get him to understand that's a part of it, something you have to accept. And with boys, it becomes something that they're involved with on a regular basis. Girls are not. for the most part. Now, gymnasts, a little bit different. That's a tough sport. But most of these girls that play tennis, that's all they play. They don't have an introduction to football or baseball or basketball. And with my kids, that's what I'm trying to push is become an athlete. And
let me ask you a question. Listen, we're talking about girls. I watch girls tennis, and I've been studying it here for a while. I'm not by any – in fact, most women say I'm not a real good expert on women.
None of us are, believe me.
But I can philosophize about it. Now since Billie Jean King, mm-hmm. nobody's told them they can't play.
Right.
But when we look at the stats, you see – more girls probably playing tennis than boys. Now, somebody could call in and tell us we're wrong, but you probably see more girls playing tennis than boys before the age of 14. But by the time they get to 18, it's four times as many boys playing as girls. They get to be about 15, and girls make a decision that they don't want to play anymore. Do you have any insight on that?
It's the first time that question's been posed to me and the first time those facts have been presented to me. It's one worth pondering. I don't really know what to say about it except that you've probably got boys more involved in athletics, generally speaking, than girls, and they're probably going to stick with it for a longer period of time because if you think about athletics in this country and you think about the major sports and the promotion of them, it's primarily for boys, if you really think about it, you know.
And I would think in tennis, though, they're promoting the women as hard as they can. I mean, in tennis, they probably get as much.
Yeah, but I'm talking athletics overall.
Right.
And when you think about athletics on a broad spectrum and the promotion of it, the glorification of it, you know, who do they talk about?
Could part of it be the maturation? I mean, they mature sooner than we do, don't they?
Yeah,
I mean,
they just get smarter and get out of it, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
that might be the case. I don't know. That might be the case.
Coach, let's move on to the problem segment. After this next commercial, we're going to take a commercial, and when we come back, we're going to discuss the problem segment and maybe broach the subject of whether or not tennis is even a viable sport for the black community.
This is Jason Haynes, the UR Tennis Network's Chief Executive Officer. Over the last 14 months, we have undergone a lot of changes here at the UR Tennis Network, and the Nike Tennis Camps have been one of our strongest supporters. They have had a very successful 2012 summer camp season and now are planning for 2013. We would like to thank them for allowing us to be an advertising avenue for their tennis camps. As we leave the summer, we want to encourage you to check out www.ussportcamps.com and start planning your next Nike camp experience. They have locations all over the U.S. for both adults and juniors. The Nike camps are offered in other sports such as golf, volleyball, soccer, swimming, softball, running, water polo, lacrosse, and field hockey. We want to encourage you to consider the Nike camp experience for your tennis needs. These camps are run by successful tennis coaches and offer a fun camp involvement where you learn new skills and make new friends. Be sure to check them out at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
Hope everybody enjoyed it. All our bumper music is the Bryan Brothers.
Oh, okay.
It's the Bryan Brothers, you know, and he's one of the guys I just can't get enough of, Wayne Bryan. He is excellent in academics, athletics, and the arts. You know, he fantastic, you know, the way he introduced tennis to his kids and kept them interested and alive in that sport to this point where, they, you know, they're late and they're double scared and they still can't wait to get out there. Like to play. Coach, before we went off, I mentioned, let me set this up a little bit. I've had a little bit of struggle here at Laurel Park in terms of being able to connect on some level, you know, pragmatically, politically, practically. And Tabani, you're in here, and you've been here the whole time, financially, in the black community. Mm-hmm. Now, we started out here, Coach. We had kids hanging on the fences, and we invited them in. And then we had white parents mad that the black kids that weren't paying came in. And we had Tabani, it was all part of that. Boy, I was like scratching my head. There was a movie about this. I mean, I'm thinking, golly, this is like reality TV stuff. So I had that going on. Then I go, I experienced something that I had never experienced. I experienced racism. I went and I have to be a little bit careful here, but part of the municipality here, they didn't want me here because I wasn't the right color. But I'm being honest about it. So at least that's my perception of it, let's say. So I've had all these struggles to get in here and do this stuff and get the funding and things of that nature. And I don't like the fact that a lot of times we're afraid to broach these subjects with one another. I think that we progress through some confrontation and we don't be afraid about things and we talk about things. If we can talk about things together on this kind of stuff, we can get to some level of understanding. So I pose a question to you, Coach. Is actually tennis, I mean, we tried, USGA's tried, everybody's tried to introduce tennis to the black community. Is tennis the right, or is it a viable sport for the black community to be playing?
Yeah. Well, I think that it is. I think that you have to change the way you approach it by understanding the dynamic of the game. If you look back at when we all learned to play basketball, learned to play football, when we learned to play baseball, it wasn't in a structured format. We went out there and we learned to play, and we got good enough at it, and the coach noticed us at 10, 12, 13 years of age, and then we were brought into a structured program where, you know, we were taught the essentials of the game. Tennis is a little bit different, and it is a disciplined sport. It requires that you learn it correctly from the very beginning if you want to be proficient later. So it's different in that regard, and I think we have to take that into account. The other thing that I think that has to be taken into account is that you can't pose it as if you've got to learn it, or we've got to have 8% black participation and stuff like that. And we've got to start with the parents and not so much with the kids. Because I think it's something that is passed in the household. How can you take a kid and teach him something that the parents and the family know nothing about and expect them to be supportive of it? So, and if you're looking at Atlanta, and Atlanta's a unique situation where we have the leagues, ALTA and UST and stuff like that, the majority of the players that I see, even though we have a large number of kids playing, are adults. But if you look at the adult players that are involved, the majority of those players are white. They're not black players. And I think that's a reflection of what's going on around the country. And I think if we redirect the efforts at teaching the parents, because adults do play, the kids will follow. Dad that plays baseball, a lot of times his son plays baseball. Mom that played volleyball, a lot of times his daughter plays volleyball. So we're trying to introduce a sport to kids that's totally foreign to a household. And that's going to be tough.
Well, one thing that you mentioned earlier, when you mentioned something that kind of struck a note with me, I think, you know, when I was in I lived for 2 years in Mexico. I played on that little Chrysler Circuit Tour down there and then worked and was at the La Quinta Club down there in Mexico. Man, it was a fun environment.
Yeah.
It was a relaxed environment. It wasn't what – now, you mentioned everything seems to be very structured here in tennis these days.
It is.
Okay. And that – I don't remember the year. Maybe 89, 90. I'm up in San Jose – or 88, I'm in San Jose coaching a girl at Nationals. Or somewhere in there, I'm in San Jose coaching a girl at Nationals. And I go to clap for a kid. She had a good shot, and I clap. An official walks around and comes up to me Like there was a move like this in Tabani. Now you don't know what I'm talking about. You're from Zimbabwe. I bet this rings true to you. But the official in San Jose comes up to me, the lady, very prim and proper, you know, dressed, you know, just perfect official attire, comes up to me, sort of waddles over, and she says, "You have to refrain from clapping." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, the parents of the girl of, you know, of your kid's parents are thinking that you've got coded messages in your clapping." I just said I couldn't believe it because I'm not smart enough to code. I can barely do the board on this thing here and get it right. Y'all know that from the start of the show. But go down to Mexico, and I'm, you know, it's a different culture, okay?
Yeah.
Beautiful courts and things of that nature. But you play a tournament. I was playing a tournament. People sitting right at the court drinking beers and, you know, yeehawing and having a great, I mean, it's an awesome time. Children's tournaments, the daddies are drinking beers, you know, throwing back some cold ones and, you know, watching it. And it's almost like pickup basketball down at the park back in Greensboro, Carolina when I was growing up, in a sense. I mean, yeah, it's an event. You got to pay for it. Here, it is so structured. You're right, Coach. You saw some of these parents out here today. I mean, I'm telling you, it's so structured that it's not inviting.
It's almost become too clinically, too starchy.
Yes.
You know, and if you look at pickup basketball games or even a pickup football game, something like that, there's a lot more interaction. It's more lively. It's like the difference between somebody dancing hip hop and somebody clock. You know, you've got to have some looseness about it. You've got to feel the flow of what you're involved in. And you can't be out there just two-stepping the whole time.
But I think tennis used to, when I grew up.
Well, I think they tried to incorporate that in this World Team Tennis thing, this format. We've got music and you've got cheerleaders and all that kind of stuff, which is still almost a pre-scripted approach to it. Let the people be just like when you play Davis Cup with Argentina. You know, they're going to be live and they're going to be involved.
Let me see if I've got this right here. I'm gonna try to find it up here. We had JW Eisenhower on here some time ago, and when JW was on, he was talking about Do I have it on here? Let's see if we've got it right. Here, we're gonna try this. Let me see.
Always. Consider myself in loco parentis when I'm dealing with young people. But I wanted to be involved with their athletics, but I wanted their family to raise them.
That's the wrong clip. Hold on a second. I'm going to find this clip here. And I know this seemed a little off. It didn't look like it loaded earlier in the show. Is this it?
Always.
Nope, that's the same one.
Academy. There have been some good results from that.
That's some Cameron.
I think tennis is losing its mentored aspect. I think when you start getting large groups of kids together, and one person is in charge of it, then it's very hard to build a mentorship. With a young person. And if you're trying to find someone to teach your child or work with a person, I think they should be the kind of person that you feel confident leaving, that they're the one that competitor looks to or they're doing, and that it needs to be basically one person that can help them with that, and that person has also got to use tennis to lessons of life.
Now, if everybody didn't get that, it's J.W. Eisenhower. He's a former coach at NCAA. He's talking about the mentorship, and I guess it leads me to, you know, you're talking about a little, you know, everything seems to be so structured now. In a sense, I think that's part of the problem. When you talk about your style of coaching, you're not really involved with big groups and things like that. You like a smaller situation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I feel it's more beneficial to the students because you get a more hands-on, feel for things, actually more directly involved with them. If I'm teaching a group of 14 or like an Alta team where I have 16 ladies at a practice in the night for 2 hours, I really can't give them individual instruction. You can't do it because if you do that, then you're really denying 15 other players. Same way with kids. When I'm working with juniors, I limit my classes to 6 kids because I have to give them individual because I want to see them progress as quickly as possible. If I'm running an academy-type situation, in most situations that I've seen, the numbers are is probably, in kids to one instructor. And that's for, usually go an hour and a half, but that's not enough time to get the kids the type of attention.
But now, when you got, so the point we're trying to make here is whether or not the structure creates the barriers to getting black people to this. Is that
well, I don't think that the structure creates the barriers. It's just the introduction. See, the USTA is focused on trying to get the kids, the parents have to understand.
Numbers to introduce more tennis to more people, and what they're saying is by these bigger numbers,
mm-hmm.
we're gonna hit more black people if we're hitting at bigger numbers.
Well, I think you probably are. You're probably gonna tap into more numbers. I'll give an example: City of Atlanta ran a program that I did with them some years ago. Went to Benjamin E. Mays High School. I went to a period. They put me in the gymnasium. The Hoppers brought in every PE class, well, every class that was having PE at that time brought into the gym. Had about 200 kids. We did have the numbers, but how effective was it? Zero. Because you had kids climbing ropes, you had kids getting kissing back in the corners, you had all kinds of things going on other than tennis. And it's the way you set it up that makes the difference. It's not the numbers. Because I don't care if you introduce tennis to 10 million families, you're not expected to get, 10 million players out of that. You've got to be realistic about the numbers. So your approach has got to be a little bit more, a little better directed to get numbers that stay. But that's what it comes down to is how many of them do you get to actually stay in the sport?
And why don't they stay?
The direction has to be more toward the family. So that the families will understand that they will be able to mentor these kids more so than the USDA or even us as coaches.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me try and touch on this. I'm trying to be as candid as I can. You spent a lot of time inside the perimeter.
Yeah.
In the urban area.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're down in Stockbridge. In my mind, that's rural compared to the urban center of Atlanta.
It is.
A little more rural. You're closer to McDonald's getting out there.
Yeah, it is.
It's out there farm, and you grew up on a farm, let me ask this, the one point in the wrong, if we're shooting a shot, the U.S. State wrong, are they shooting at the wrong black kids? The urban black kids might not stick with them, tennis might stick better with rural black kids, in terms of growing them up into players.
I mean, it's hard to answer. I think that.
Yeah, I'm curious. First of all, is it a valid question?
I think it's a valid question. I think that's something that the USTA has to consider. I think from the standpoint of where the sport is, has been traditionally, it's been a sport for those who are educated, better situated in terms of their finances and their job positions, even in the white community. And so if that's been the case, traditionally in the white community,
I guess Todd Martin mm-hmm. came from a lot of money.
So
but now Sanders didn't come from a lot of money, and he starts back
a lot of money,
back
but it's access, and it's a culture that you're coming from, I'm just speaking my opinion. I'm not a sociologist, but traditionally.
Just job talking.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm so comfortable saying it because I know I'm not a feedback. what you're talking about. Look at
but
the
there's
sport.
Something to this job talking. But what I want to try and get, I want to get some understanding from you. And
well,
so let's keep going down.
And what I try to do is analogies with the sports that we are involved in.
Okay.
You know, we're involved heavily in basketball and football. It used to be basically.
How come we can't get the black people in tennis that we have in basketball and football?
Because I think there's a tradition of those sports in those households. You know, that's what I've been trying to do all along.
Now, you're a black man from another country.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking at him kind of, if y'all can see how he's looking at Tamani, you're from Zimbabwe.
Yes,
sir. Is he going the right way?
I would say yes in terms of here in the USA, because I've seen it as well. But I'm telling you right now, I'm coming from Southern Africa, where I can go down the street and you got kids in the neighborhood who have no shoes on, playing on concrete courts.
Well, what sport are they playing?
Tennis.
Now, what is the predominant sport in that area? What do you see?
Soccer.
Exactly.
Soccer.
You see. And soccer will be passed down. Tennis will be second to soccer. It's the same way here with basketball. Tennis is going to come in second to it because those are the sports those kids play. Do you see them playing baseball?
No.
Exactly. And that's what we compete against here.
I asked y'all, I'm going to go ahead and ask. I asked y'all a question off the air. I'm going to ask it on the air. Why do I care? Well, first of all, it doesn't seem to matter to black people if I want them to play tennis or not. Okay? I've lost out. Okay? But it seems, here I'm a white guy. Why do I even care what color somebody is if they play tennis?
Well,
why do I care?
The color.
Why should I care?
Well, I'm going to say the truth, and I'll say this to the black man to you. The color of the player should not matter. Do because you're trying to broaden the impact of the sport. You're concerned with the sport and not so much with the participants. I mean, they're important, but you do it because you want the sport to be better. You know, and that's really the reason that you care and the reason that you do what you do. It's going to be better if you get these kids involved. It's going to be better not only for them, but for everyone else that has exposure to them.
Can I try to play devil's advocate?
Right.
Is it actually going to be better? I mean, some people will argue. Some people argue. They will say, "Look, the reason we've got so structured and sterile is we have to control things a whole lot more because maybe we you know before it was unwritten rules. You know, you didn't say this and you didn't do that. Now we're dealt with this." You know, we got kids that aren't educated in the cultural moral ways of coming and playing tennis, and we had kids coming out there, you know, pounding the ground, and we had shoes, you know, they're swatting rocks instead of, you know what I mean? So we spent time educating them and getting them, but I guess what I'm trying to get at respect, and it might not sound right what I'm saying, but hopefully it'll come out if I can articulate it to you. If you appeal to the broad common base and you try to make tennis everything to everybody, does it not lose some of what it made it attractive to begin with? It was a sport kind of, you know, set aside. You know, it was something that had lured you.
Well, it wasn't so the
you know what I mean, Mr. Graham?
It was the challenge of it that lured
right.
me. Right. Because I'm an athlete by nature and my heart, and I think that that's a little different.
Now, Coach Creasy says a lot. Now, we're getting somewhere here. Coach Creasy says something a lot of times. He talks about appealing to the kings and queens in us and not the peasants in us. You know, in other words, appealing to the king and queen in a man
mm-hmm.
and what he can be and not, you know, going to the lower portion. So can you broaden the base of tennis and at the same time appeal to the king and queen and men?
Okay. That's the educational part of this thing. That's what your job is to teach them the proper etiquette for this sport. See? And I think these kids that you're talking about that you gave the rackets to, that broke the strings in them, it's because they did not understand, for the most part, the etiquette that's involved. They may cut, the local basketball players, because that's what they know. They don't
so
know
we
the kids
them We gave them shoes, we gave them clothes, we gave them...
Yes, but you haven't given them the feel for the sport. Sure, you gave them the shoes. But you do that because you have an understanding of the sport and what the sport requires. You know about tennis whites at Wimbledon? I tell you, absolutely, they do not. Yeah, you know. And it used to be that way throughout the sport, but they modified that to the point where colors in most sports. But you've got to get them to understand what the sport requires, you know, and what it means to be a tennis player. And that's what you do.
Let me ask this. When in the black community, and you got the football players and the basketball players and the baseball players or whatever, you know, and maybe in soccer too, do they look at tennis? I remember, I won't relate that story, but do they look at tennis as being a sissy sport?
I did. I know I did.
Is that part of the problem?
I don't think, in a contemporary sense, I don't think it is now so much. I think now that the kids have so many other diversions, you almost have to bring tennis to their attention, because there's no thought process that goes into considering tennis. I mean, why else would they? Because I guarantee you, they are preoccupied with electronics, all the games and video stuff and all that kind of stuff, and the texting and the phones. And then when they think of athletics, the athletic scene in this country is dominated by the three major sports. You know, it's pretty much basketball and football and then baseball.
We get a great slew. I get a great slice of life here at the park. I think we do, somebody. Because I tell you, look, the black kids that we see walking through the park, they ain't got the electronics. They got a basketball under their arm, and they're going down there to that basketball court, and their life is physical. Physicality.
Yeah.
Now, reading Wayne Bryan's book, my son, I don't know TV.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts when he's playing a video game. I take it away from him. I mean, I want my son to be as physical.
You live right across the street from a housing project. Right. Your facility is right across the street from a housing project. How many kids do you think live in that project? I mean, what, 600, 700, 300,
yeah.
400, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many do you see coming across your basketball?
Lot.
I mean, now,
it's
not
the only activity they're coming across.
I know. I'm talking about the ones with the basketball in it. You're probably going to see, what, 6 or 7 kids at a time coming across the basketball.
In groups, I mean, there are times where it's packed down there.
Yeah, maybe packed, but even if it's packed, that's going to be a small percentage of the numbers that exist across there.
Okay.
See? So to say they're coming across without the electronics, without the phone, you got a limited number. You got the kids that want to be athletes. You got the kids that are hooked on basketball. You know, you don't have all those kids. The majority of them are still over there doing those other things. And the other things you mentioned earlier that you know, are on the other side of the legal statutes. But that's what I'm talking about. You still have a large majority of the kids.
So here I am. You know, let's say, just for the sake of argument, that here at this park, I'm part of the tennis establishment.
Yeah.
Now, I've made it honest, and I haven't quit.
That's
with Tabani, I've made an honest effort. Now, and I'll tell you this, one thing I can't stand about the USTA, and you know this, Tabani, because we've talked about it. They come in, boy, I talked to Mrs. Blunt about it. I talked to a lot of people about this, and this is the lady that runs one of the local recreation centers for you guys out in California listening to the show, or Texas, or some of these other places. But USTA will come in with a schools program. Bring in a few rackets, bring in a few nets, come in one or two times, and leave. And they leave the kids high and dry.
That's exactly what happened.
And remember I told you, I explained to the lady that runs the local rec program, I wanted to come in and work with the kids, and I didn't want the rug ripped out from under them. Well, you know, that one didn't work, and you know, I didn't appeal to her. But, where does as someone's in my position, I got a chance to make a difference here.
Yeah.
Now I'm not gonna. I personally don't think I need to do it based on race at all.
No, I agree.
Okay, but I do have a situation where I have a rec center where I've got some kids. It's kind of like, I mean, I don't know. They don't get let out hardly at all in the day. They stay inside most of the summer, and then they get let out to play some tennis. And it's like a great thing for them. We went over there and we did a fantastic job. I took about, I don't know, about five to ten staff with us. Had 200 kids, and we blew the doors off. What I hate about it is not being able to deliver on that and follow through, because that's how tennis works. That's how you're going to get good in tennis. You're not going to get good in tennis. And I don't mean to cut you off, but now. What does a guy like me do?
Well, the first thing you don't do is you don't give up. Because the only way you're going to reach those kids is be consistent with the effort. And that's the problem the USTA has had. They give lip service to it, they make a presentation and they disappear, just like you said. I've been involved in those programs and seen it for years. The only way to keep those kids involved is to develop an interest and maintain and nurture that interest with your own participation. And that's what comes from your heart. That's where you approach it from. And if you're sincere with your desire to see them involved, to get them involved, then you'll stay with it and you'll see the results. And it's like playing this game. Nobody becomes a really good tennis player overnight. And I guarantee you won't have that involvement overnight. But you stay in it because you know that over the long term you will get it if you stay involved and you stay genuinely involved.
Let's move on to the next segment.
Okay, sounds good to me.
And our next segment I devoted every week, and I don't know how it strikes you. I'm kind of curious. It's another. So, you know, here we come with another mandate from USTA. It's a 10 and under mandate.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how does it strike you?
When I first saw it and that information about the program, I could understand what they're trying to do, and I think it was mimicked off of some soccer programs that they were using in Europe where they had, shorter soccer fields and all that kind of stuff. Then I looked back and I thought back on my upbringing and how I was involved in football and basketball and baseball, and I remember that when I played basketball, I don't think that we played on 6-foot rims and used smaller balls and all that kind of stuff. We played the game the way that it was played, and we just adapted. And I really am not in favor of shorter courts and softer balls and smaller rackets and all that kind of stuff.
Is it going to bring more black kids to tennis?
No. I don't think it was designed for black kids. I think it was just an overall attempt by the USTA to justify, I think, the fact that, we didn't have as many kids staying in the sport. And the kids don't stay because you have shorter courts or because you have softer balls. They stay because they develop an interest, and that's where the coaches come into play. You have to make it fun. You have to involve yourself with them. It has to be something they enjoy doing. Do you think the kids come out because the court's shorter? Do they come out because the ball is softer? How many kids have walked up to you and said, "Coach JP, I love the fact that we've got a shorter court and softer balls"?
Everybody, it's very clear my views on it. I'm very interested in the idea. You almost sort of laughed about the idea that it's not going to bring more black kids into it. Now there's a professor, a Dr. Brown in Houston. He actually looks at it as it almost disenfranchises more black people because of the cost of putting. You think about it. We've got a guy. Have you ever seen any of the Bruce Tarrin videos?
I have not.
Before you leave today, I'm gonna send you, or you need to see some of these Bruce Tarrin videos. But he talks about the cost of introducing Quick Start to his kids at his club.
Uh-huh.
Now that's a daunting cost at the club, and that's more staff and blah 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 blah. Okay, when you and then he juxtaposes that, or he compares that to another part of Europe that doesn't, they still got the yellow ball and a normal court, yeah, and a normal net. Dr. Brown looks at it and he says, look, for the city of Houston, it's going to cost X millions of dollars to fully integrate Quick Start courts into all the public courts so that everybody that's doing it has the same equal access to it. Now, that's a lot of mumbo, there's a lot of stuff there. But in there, there's a kernel of some truth to that.
Well, it's another limiting factor when it comes to, introducing the sport.
They're going to tell you, though, they're going to say this, though. USTA is going to say to you, look, we can introduce it now in the streets to kids. We don't need a tennis court to introduce it. We can do tennis in the gyms now because of this. We can introduce tennis in a lot of different ways. How long ago were you doing that program at gyms?
We did that, and it was just a situation where they just threw me in the middle of it. It was a basketball court in the gymnasium. It was probably 16, 17 years ago.
So you didn't need a Quick Start court to introduce tennis to kids?
I just needed an exit door, because there was about 400 kids, and I was by myself. That's what I was going to need. I wanted to get by and get out of there, because it didn't make any sense. But, it was their way of introducing. And like I said before, you can appreciate to some degree the intentions of the USTA. But I think sometimes you get the feeling that they haven't thought things all the way through. They've got to throw stuff out there because they're taking in dollars, and they've got to defend themselves. And a lot of times you get these programs and you stop, what in the world were they thinking? You know, and I don't know how much grassroots input they get. I don't know how much time they spent at facilities like yours and like mine before they do this.
Okay, your place in Stockbridge, Georgia, how many courts you've got?
16.
How many of them are quick start lined?
All of them? Two courts.
Two?
Yeah.
Only two?
We only did two, and I'm glad they only did two. Because we had the temporary lines initially, the little yellow plastic ones, and I thought that was good enough. That was an expense. Well, we flushed that money through those quick start, the temporary lines down.
Do you run tournaments?
Not 10 and under. Now, in fact, right now...
You can't run anything if you don't run 10 and under down.
Yeah, and so...
They changed, the USGA changed that on you.
Yeah.
That's why we had to get them here. Yeah. I don't know if you know this, we had, you know, we were looking at any kind of event to get here at our park, and we had the USGA National fly in for the Pro Tour. We wanted to put a women's tour event here. She flew in, got out of the car, saw the quick start lines, and got back in the car basically and said, you can't run pro events here. Why? Because you got quick start lines.
That was my argument. when the county wanted to put the lines down,
uh-huh.
My question was, I told them, I said, would you call the USGA and tell us why you don't see those lines at Louis Armstrong or Arthur Ashe Stadium? Why don't they have the quick start lines marked on those courts for the tournaments? I've never seen it on TV. Yeah, maybe I don't have HD, I don't know. But I don't see the blue lines on the court up there, you know. And it's such a big deal and something they want to emphasize, then why do we have Federer not playing on that court with those blue lines on it? But I mean, you know, that's like I said before, that's the USGA and that's the way they do things. You just have to kind of go along with it since they're the governing organization. I don't really necessarily agree with it, and maybe that's just because I'm old school and hard-headed and just don't understand what's going on, and that's why I limit myself too.
Now let me say this part of it, because I don't like that, and I don't like that sort of attitude about it. They actually have made it a mission because you're resistant to it. That's they don't have a problem, officials with the USGA, in typifying you in that matter. If you're resistant to quick start, if you're resistant to 10 and under, you're hard-headed, you're old school, and old school is no good anymore, and it, blah, blah, this and blah, blah, that. You know, I mean, we just had last week Doug Pilot on the show. And Doug had hired Paul Scarpa after something like 40 years of coaching at Furman, retired and moved to Charleston. And Doug Pilot, who's a young pro about our age, 48, hired Paul Scarpa. And he says, best hire he ever had. Most dependable, most reliable, most enthusiastic, hardest working assistant he'd ever had. And he's old school. And he's better than any of the young school guys you can bring in.
No.
So, good to have an experience. And I don't want you to, you know, I don't know that it's that case. I think it is probably a different case. I personally think there's a lot of money involved in it, but we're not here to find out about my ideas. We got a little bit of time left in the live portion of the show, and I know you need to get back down to Stockbridge. It's a long drive. Let's move on to the next segment. And we'll try to follow up here with maybe one or two more things. This is the game changer segment. In your mind, now you started tennis late, but you've been through a lot of change in tennis, and you've actually seen, for example, you've gone from segregated tennis to integrated tennis to wooden rackets to metal rackets. Now, you've seen a lot of change in your lifetime. To you, what is the biggest change that you've experienced or seen or...
Well, I think the biggest thing that I've seen has been the exposure.
How do you mean?
Through television. You know, because when I was coming up...
So the Tennis Channel is the biggest...
Tennis Channel, the fact that they cover all the Grand Slams, you can watch tennis 24-7. I think that's probably the same thing for most sports now, because it's almost, you're almost oversaturated with it. But for tennis, it's brought tennis to a larger audience, and more people understand than they were when I was coming up. The only time I remember seeing any tennis at all was when they would play these wide world sports, where somebody would show the U.S. Open finals. You never saw anything other than that, than the finals. You know, but right. Now you get qualifying, you get first round events, you get tournaments from Monte Carlo, from Taipei, everywhere. And to me, that's been the biggest thing. It's exposure to the money. The money's come along with it as well. Because kids can now associate financial success not just with basketball and football, but with tennis, because guys are making money now. And I think that's going to increase the incentive the kids have to participate in the sport. It's just going to take time. It's going to take a little bit of time.
Coach Graham, let me follow up with one little thing that we're going to go into the follow-up segment, and it's something that you and I touched on a little bit, and I played a little bit of his thing. I want to ask you about, in the clip, let me set the clip up for you. Again, we had J.W. Eisenhower on the show, and I watched a little interaction with you and some parents, and I watched that you handled them so well and so adeptly. And J.W. has a philosophy about parents and Wayne Brown. Now, recently, Courier was quoted as saying, history, you know, political correctness says parents stay out of it.
Yeah.
History shows the ones that are involved, those are the kids that are successful. Coaches, you and me and a lot of us, we want parents, y'all need to stay out. Let's listen to J.W. here, and then when we listen to J.W., I'd like you to comment on what he has to say.
Okay.
Basically, I think most parents have no idea what the child is going through on the court. They have absolutely no idea. So I think when the child finishes playing, they should tell them they enjoyed watching them play. Let's go get something to eat. Find out what time your next match is, and let somebody else handle the part where they... you're the person that has to tell them to, you know, to pick up their clothes and clean their room and be involved with their schoolwork and their mentorship in how you want them to grow up. But it's hard to mix a competitive situation like a competitive sport where you really don't have any idea. And I say this, I don't know many people who played at the professional level. And
Coach, how does that strike you? Is he on target? Is he off target?
Well, I think he's on target too, because I think for us coaches, you know, I think we want to handle our clinics with as few hindrances as possible. And parents can be a hindrance to you doing your job, because their concern is going to be with their child. And so a lot of times you'll find them kind of, you know, solely interested in the progress of their child, and they can do that to the point where they're disruptive to the class. I tell my parents all the time, if they will just remain parents, be supportive, they'll never fail, because that's what they are, number one. You know, if they were better coaches, then they wouldn't be hiring me. So if they allow me to do the coaching, allow me to do the corrections, allow me to address the concerns with the kid when it comes to tennis, they're going to be much better off. And just be a supportive factor for the kids. Because the kids are under enough structure. They're not on enough stress just from me. They don't need to face me and my constant criticism, my constant addressing things, and come off the court and have the parent doing the same thing. They don't get a break. So the parent, I think, should be a parent and supportive, and allow the coaching to be done by the coaches.
Does this philosophy of yours come from your background in football, baseball, and basketball, or does this come from you seeing tennis as the need for that?
I think it just comes from my overall experience in athletics. I think that you have experts. I mean, I don't go to the doctor, take my kid to the doctor, and then when I leave the doctor, tell them, don't take that, I'm going to give you something that's going to be better for you. I trust the doctor's advice. That's why I went to him. That's why I paid him. I think it's the same thing if you have a tennis instructor, because they're supposed to be professionals. And you have to make sure that you've got a person, somebody that you trust. If you trust them, let them do what they're supposed to do.
Why do we see so many we had a parent who was watching a baseball game. He didn't like the ump's call, he went out and took one of the bats and hit the umpire in the head and put him in the hospital. Big lawsuit, big deal, about 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know if you remember reading that. In El Paso, Texas, in soccer, they had an incident. Here in North Atlanta soccer, they had an absolute riot. You've seen the clips in football where parents crowded onto the field, beat the umpire to death over the results of a call.
I think they killed a hockey coach up in New England.
They may have killed a hockey coach up in New England. In tennis, I was at one time, I heard about this. I wasn't there to see it. But the way it was described to me, two parents locked horns inside a cabana, and all the other parents could see and their kids could see is those two dads rolling down the stairs fighting one another. Agassi family and the Tarango family lock horns at the Easter Bowl back in the 1980s. What is it going on? What's going on in sports? Did this happen back when you were playing?
Well, I mean, you know, you saw it because you've seen instances of this nature. And I don't think tennis is going to be any different than other sports because you have it in soccer. You know, you have the soccer riots, and we just kind of almost expect it. You have the fans at football games, the Giant fans and the Eagle fans. They go at each other. You've seen the Redskins and the Cowboy fans. We saw this incident.
But did they cross this line years ago?
I don't think.
You think of your dad as going in? I mean, can you think of any instance? I couldn't imagine my father.
No, when you put it that way, you're probably right, because I think coaches have a little bit more respect, and there was probably more respect from the parents
for the coach,
for the coaches and for the whole institution. Nowadays, there seems to be a laxity when it comes to our acceptance of standards. You know, we don't want standards. We just want to be able to do what we want to do based on the emotions of the moment. You're right. We did not see that before. But I think it still comes down to a situation where in tennis, and I don't know if it probably goes up to other sports where you have the Monday morning quarterbacks who are second-guessing everything. You've got these parents who play a little bit of tennis, and they think they can second-guess everything. And that's where you have to reach an understanding with them in the very beginning. You know, this is what you've gotten yourself into. You know, I do the coaching. You do the parenting. It's limited at that. And it's not going to change these confrontations that we're talking about, but hopefully it'll make it a little bit easier for the coaches when it comes to dealing with parents and limiting that interference that you get from parents. And I think that's what Chris Eisenhower was talking about, you know, keeping the parents out of the coaching end of it. Let the coach do the coaching so the kids are not confused by conflicting sets of instructions.
I'll tell you one thing, and we're about ready to close off here because I know you've got to get back to Stockbridge and you've got to get home. And, you know, we're past the live portion of the show. But let me make one comment and see, and get your reaction to it, and then we'll close it off. You know, today with the kids, they're faced with so many other problems too, probably that you and I didn't have. So when the parents get involved in the tennis, it's a little bit screwy. And here's what I mean. They get involved in the tennis because they're trying to repair a relationship with the kid that they weren't establishing on other grounds. Does that make sense? Now, when they get real screwy and they get all these temptations and everything else, you need to be there to be able to parent, to with your daughter, be able to talk to her about the things that she should and shouldn't be doing with her body. I'm talking about, you know, from sex to drugs and everything else, to be able to do that. And if you're fighting a fight all the time about the tennis portion of it, you're going to lose that opportunity to really deal with something that really matters. The tennis, I don't know, really matters, does it? As much as these bigger lessons in life that we need to face, right?
Well, I think that is the perspective that the parent needs to take. You know, they need to address these more important issues as a parent. And I think that you leave the coaching part of it. Don't dilute your opportunities, your influence, the strength of your word by getting, you know, spread out into too many areas. Trust the coach that you've hired, that you've got working with him, and let him do that. And then you deal with the academics. You deal with the social side of raising a child. Deal with the disciplinary side of raising a child at home. But don't try to broaden it out to the point where you're the the know-all and do-all in everything, in every aspect of that child's life, because they're gonna really come to the point where they resent it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what parents have to understand. You know, allow the coach to do it, trust it, leave it alone, and then be the parent. You know, talk to your kids about what happened. Don't tell them so much as quiz them about things and find out what they have to tell you as opposed to what you have to tell them. And I think that works out better if you're a tennis parent.
I like this stuff. Maybe I'll send you on over to Lisa Stone, and she's got a show, Parent and Aces. You are a parent and ace. Coach, you are a coach and ace. You are a coaching mentor to the kids. I enjoyed meeting you today. I am so grateful to you for coming on the show tonight. Tamani, I'm grateful for you coming in as well. We had a great show here. I look forward to this show every week, doing it. We learn. And I love bringing to light a guy like yourself. Now, you say you're going to retire. I hope you don't retire. You've got a lot left to give to the kids.
Well, that's an example. And I hope that will be the case. But the other thing I want to mention before we get off the air is that when we talk about coaching, I think it's just, it probably applies as much here as any place else, is that we kind of emphasize the kids today. Don't forget the adults, because they're a big portion of the tennis community when it comes to us coaches. And, you know, the same rules apply in dealing with those adults that deal with the kids. It's that we do it right from the beginning, and we take accountability for what we do. And
Coach, I enjoyed having you on the show. And everybody, we'll be back next week with another show. Thank you for tuning in, and we will leave you with the wonderful You Are a Tennis disclaimer.
Opinions stated by various contributors to You Are Tennis Radio and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the You Are Tennis Network. Visitors are urged to use their own discernment to draw their own conclusions. All information, products, services, and use of this website is for personal use only. You Are Tennis Radio does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of the information contained within the website. Any services or products provided by You Are Tennis Radio and its hosts or contributors should be used solely for entertainment and enjoyment. We emphasize the importance of keeping an open mind and not construing the data, products, and/or services as factual.